Welcome to the Cycling Performance Club podcast. Before we start the show, if you have not already listened to the last episode, it's part one, and this episode is part two of our look at exercise intensity and training zones. So go listen to that one first. In this episode, we're still down the rabbit hole, talking to Dr. Nicholas Jamnik, the first author on a couple of papers on the topic that, in our opinion, are essential reading. In part one, we talked about graded exercise tests, VO2 max testing, and lactate thresholds. And the usefulness of lactate testing came down to this.
The only thing it's good for is finding that transition from baseline to above baseline, if you refine it well enough. But above that, you know, it's irrelevant. It's like that. It's one of my favorite scenes in Wolf of Wall Street. It's fugazi, it's fugazi,
it's a wazi, it's a woozy, it's a fairy dust. It doesn't exist. It's never landed.
In this episode, we go beyond lactate threshold measures with a review of all of the current methods of determining exercise intensity, which I have to give you the punchline in the intro again. Basically, all but a couple of the methods are
fugazi, fugazi.
Well, they're not validated, which is the reason why I call this review brutal. It systematically shoots down the validity of exercise intensity measures we've all used in prescribing, describing, and recording training. So I've got a question for you. How do you think your method fared? Does it actually measure something or just say it does? And I'm not going to lie, this is really messy. As Jason says,
this is where the rabbit hole lies within training, one of the big ones, I think. With this, there's quite a bit of controversy around exercise intensity and how it's prescribed.
That said, there is value in trying to make sense of this fundamental component of training. Because without properly understanding where you've been, what you're going to do, and the kind of results you're likely going to get, you won't have a chance at maximizing your potential. Welcome to the Cycling Performance Club podcast, the podcast where scientists, pro cyclists, and cutting-edge coaches discuss topics in training, performance, science, and all things cycling.
The show is co-hosted by me, Cyrus Monk, a professional cyclist and cycling coach.
Me, Dr. Jason Boynton, a sports scientist and cycling coach.
And then there's me, Damien Roos, a professional cycling coach. And in this episode, we take a deep dive into exercise intensity and training zones with Dr. Nicholas Jamnik's review on the topic called
An Examination and Critique of Current Methods to Determine Exercise Intensity.
This review evaluated different methods of prescribing intensity based on their ability to cause the distinct responses found in each of the domains of exercise. The methods were categorized into three groups: maximal anchors, submaximal anchors, and delta methods. And we're going to explore why most of these methods failed and why only a couple of them didn't. And I will warn you, in this episode, there are some controversial opinions and outcomes that will challenge your ideas about exercise intensity and training zones. But this is a genuine search for better ways to prescribe intensity. And certainly from time to time, if we don't challenge ourselves and science, especially methods which have become ingrained without scientific validation or much understanding, the purpose of science is pointless. And hey, questioning your own methods and in the end using an accurate method will help you design more effective training programs that can lead to greater performance improvements. And this is something that should help everybody. Sports scientists, researchers, clinicians, coaches, and athletes get better results. Here's the job of training zones: to give us a way to prescribe workout intensities. What fascinates me about the debate around exercise intensity is that some people simply don't care whether their method to prescribe workout intensities is valid as long as it's reliable. And this goes for amateurs all the way to the top of sport.
When I presented this review in a presentation and I was talking about the validity, reliability, going, and I had this guy tell me, doesn't matter if it's valid as long as it's reliable. And I'm like, I don't know, I really know what to say to that, man. So I guess we'll just go to the next question. So, and you know, he's got gold medals, some of his athletes. So who am I to say, I guess, right?
Yeah. I mean, we talk about on the program, it's like, yeah, you can train with critical power, but there's been plenty of people that have won using FTP.
Jason's right. Plenty of people have won using FTP. And I admit that I still use FTP and prescribe intensity below it as a percentage from time to time. But I will say FTP was not included in this review because they didn't even discuss putting it in, meaning, as it's not a laboratory measure per se, it was outside of the scope of this review. And that's why critical power is in there. And I'll add that I've started doing critical power tests with my athletes and have a secondary data set of CP values, but it took me a lot of exploration to understand why using an accurate intensity measure is better for the athletes I coach. And once you see reviews like this one, I mean, holy smokes, it's impossible to ignore the fact that if your method is not accurate, how can you trust you're getting the best possible outcomes in training? So I'm curious about what methods you're using and if you'll change your mind after this episode. Let's dive in and start with why Nick wrote this review. You may remember in part one, we discussed Nick's habit of questioning common assumptions. And the reason he was inspired to write this review is no different. And it goes back to his days in
Minnesota with Robert Pettit. I mean,
Minnesota,
yeah, exactly. And we, you know, we had so many, you know, he was a big skeptic of lactate threshold and heart rate zones and training zones and everything. And, you know, you can sell this domains is everything we ever learned. And it's something that I was like really believed in and was a big proponent of, especially critical power and critical speed, which, you know, published a few papers on that as well. And, you know, it kind of got, you know, with the 2018 paper, you know, I started writing this in like 2018 or something, and, you know, it took a long time to actually write, but I got frustrated because it's like, you say it's a lactate threshold, but what is it actually measuring? Is it actually measuring something or just saying, you just say it, it is now, you just say it, it comes out of thin air. And so what I wanted to do was say like our criteria for our thresholds to be relied on a physiological response, right? So specific to the domains of exercise. And so I said, this is our criteria. This is our validity right here. So how does all these thresholds, can they actually determine the responses or demarcate the distinct responses between the moderate and the heavy and severe domains? And so that was the entire synthesis. So I went through, discussed all the methods, and then talked about all the literature that either supports or doesn't support that specific threshold's ability to demarcate the domains of exercise.
Did you catch that? Nick went into this review with only one thing in mind when evaluating the methods and models in the review. Can they actually demarcate the distinct responses between the moderate and heavy and the heavy and severe domains? In other words, is it a true marker of the distinct responses found in each of the exercise domains? And so me and you are both speaking the same language. Here's a refresher on exercise domains. You know, the way scientists talk about the exercise intensity spectrum.
So in the scientific and applied world, exercise intensity gets into discussions about things like thresholds, exercise domains, and graded exercise tests, as we've already kind of alluded to. And in the applied world, we get a little bit more into a discussion around training zones. I've mentioned this in the podcast before, but I think it's really important to point out the differences and similarities between exercise domains and training zones. But I've explained those domains enough on the show as is. I'm actually interested to hear how you describe the domains and see how they're different and what I can pick up from you about the different exercise domains.
So if we have the moderate, which is pretty much the lowest intensity, and it's best, you know, you describe it systemically as a plateau in oxygen consumption within 3 minutes, blood lactate values that remain at baseline. So if we're talking baseline value, you know, right around one, obviously it fluctuates for everybody, and you're essentially relying on type 1 muscle fibers to produce the force, and you're getting your ATP from oxidative phosphorylation or from mitochondria ATP turnover. So no, you know, what we would call lactate, we'd call like a cytosolic ATP production. And then the heavy domain is obviously the one above that. And what you see here is you see a delayed VO2 response, so a delayed plateau, if you will, or what's called the slow component. You see a rise in lactate above baseline. typically imply that that would mean that there's actually a increase in type 2 muscle fiber recruitment. So we're not just relying on type 1s anymore. Essentially, there's always going to be a steady state if you're in the heavy domain. So eventually you'll reach a steady state. It's just going to be delayed. Whereas severe, there is no steady state. So if you're in the severe exercise domain, you're going to see a continual increase in VO2 consumption, a continual increase in blood lactate value, as well as a continual recruitment of type 2 muscle fibers, specifically, you know, type 2X or B, whatever, which one you want to call them, until you're going to reach either fatigue or, ideally, in a perfect world, VO2 max. And then the one, you know, I don't really talk about it in the review, but the extreme is an intensity where you're relying predominantly on maybe your PCR stores. It's any intensity that's too short for you to elicit VO2 max. So rule of thumb, I don't like to put a
PCR, ATP, and then are you getting into AMP at that point?
Not necessarily. It's pretty much anything less than, you know, 2 minutes or 90 seconds. Like, again, it's a pretty hard thing to quantify, but yeah.
Training zones sit on top of these exercise domains, but define training intensities in a different way. And there's lots of different methods and models. So to help us understand the difference better,
this paper basically breaks down the methods of determining exercise intensity into like three broad groups. And those are prescribing in terms of relative to maximal anchors, prescribing in terms of relative to submaximal anchors, and then kind of this hybrid of prescribing in relative to maximal and submaximal or baseline values.
These three groups and actual methods are broken down like this. Maximal anchors, these are pretty common and include maximal oxygen uptake, VO2 max, peak oxygen uptake, VO2 peak, maximum heart rate max, and maximum work rate, power, peak power output. And these are often derived from a graded exercise test. The second is submaximal anchors, which you will recognize these thanks to the prevalence of lactate and power testing. These include the ventilatory threshold, the gas exchange threshold, the respiratory compensation point, and the first and second lactate threshold, LT1 and LT2. Other submaximal anchor measurements, such as the maximal lactate steady state and critical power, are also measures and are also derived from a graded exercise test. FTP would sit under this one if it was going to be included. Finally, there's hybrid methods, referred to in the review as delta methods, and these were new to me, and they include oxygen uptake and heart rate reserve, and they're methods based on the difference between maximums, so heart rate max or VO2 max, and resting values, VO2 resting and heart rate resting. We're going to go through these in groups, starting with
maximal anchors, and this is basically prescribing zones off of percentages of max. So why don't you give us a rundown of what it means to prescribe exercise intensity based off of maximal anchors?
Yeah, so it's, you know, exactly as it sounds, where it's a percentage of your maximum. So it's 30% of VO2 max or 70% of VO2 max or 30% of peak power or peak treadmill speed or 70%. So it's just based on that. Through the literature and ESSA textbooks and even some bad exercise physiology textbooks and ACSM, they say, well, moderate exercise is anything below 60% of VO2 max. So that's where you go. And then, you know, heavy or whatever it is, or intense exercise between 60 and 80% of VO2 max. But then, you know, what we know is that doesn't really mean anything. Again, if we get back to the domains of exercise, if you're going to assign the percent of VO2 max to the transition between moderate and heavy, for some people that's 50% of VO2 max. Some people that's 90%. Mm. Some of the research we cited to discredit that was that they exercised a group of people all at 70% of the VO2 max, and some people had a nice lactate VO2 at plateau, lactate at baseline, where some people, they saw an actual continual increase in their lactate values and continual increase in the VO2 consumption, thus showing that 70% is moderate for some people, moderate domain, and some people it's heavy domain of exercise. So you can't use this.
Yeah.
And similarly for the peak power.
Yeah. So there's a few papers that exhibit that this is a bad idea. I mean, one of them is an old Coyle paper where they had matched groups with same VO2 max. And then they had one, basically they looked at their time trial times for the two groups. They looked at who had the best time trials between the matched groups. And they found that that was related to muscle fiber type. So you can have people with the same exact VO2 max and their threshold is going to be setting at a different percentage. And that can change potentially within individuals too, in terms of their training over time. So one of the things that this relates to is these graded exercise tests that are used to determine FTP. And basically what they do is you get on your smart trainer, you do a graded exercise test to fail. Whatever your peak power is, they take that percentage, I think it was 82.5, Cyrus?
82.5 is what everyone uses. Yeah. Well, not everyone, but that's the number they pick out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But as Nick pointed out, like, that's silly. Like, there's no way. It's not to say it would always be wrong. It's just, it's that it's very unlikely to be correct, or there's a high probability that's going to be correct. There's two ways, I think, to look at this in terms of, is how we know it's wrong. Is one was with acute studies. If you just acutely exercise people at their percent of VO2 max, some people will go to failures because they're in the severe domain. Some people will be able to go for a long period of time, even though they're at the same percent heart rate, percent VO2 max, percent peak power. And then the other one is, I think there were some training studies as well, right? Because they would train these people at these percentages of VO2 max and they would get different results. And if that's one of the key points here, is why you want those to be accurate, so that when you give these zones to your athlete, you'll get the same response. So if you're saying that someone should be exercising at 50% of VO2 max all the time, well, that could be two different acute exercise responses, which are going to potentially result in two different training outcomes, even though you've prescribed them the same training zone. Yeah, that was just one of the things that kind of came out of that paper. So it's, and we talk about in terms of VO2 max, but, like, you know, not everyone's going to have a MET card at home, as we point out. So these are max heart rate zones. These are anything that's based off of peak power or watts around VO2 max. Because there's a lot of, and this is, again, a very deep discussion too, because there's different ways to determine peak power. And that peak power could be related to the graded exercise test. And we go down that same rabbit hole again, besides just the whole issues with the percentage. And getting to one of the reasons, one of the things about your paper and this review and your papers that also gets you into this, like, nihilism as well, is that all these papers I've read now, they don't make a lot of sense, because that's how they determine training intensity. And a little bit of a story about this is, I had an athlete ask me about fat max, and I was like, all right, well, and for me to really have an opinion about fat max, I have to figure out what fat max relates to in terms of exercise domains. And there's probably some papers out there. I just did a quick skim of what I had and some of the stuff that was coming up on, like, the first page of my searches, but everything's in percentage of max. I'm like, well, this doesn't tell me nothing. This doesn't, like, it's between 60 to 70% or 50 and 70% of VO2 max. I'm like, well, where is it in terms of, is it at aerobic threshold? Is it below aerobic threshold? Is it above aerobic threshold? Like, and so, like, a lot of these papers, not that I don't want to say they're worthless, but, like, man, it's going to be really hard to determine anything from them once you understand, like, how determining things off of VO2 max is not ideal.
Yeah, just quickly, we know why people are doing that. It's just because it's so easy to do. Like, the percentage of max thing, anyone can relate to, because they just think, okay, max is the maximum I can do. And then in their head, it's quite easy to be like, that's 6 out of 10 if it's 60%. So I think it's because it's so accessible is the reason people are using it. I think it's just important people realize that because it's easy and widely used doesn't necessarily mean it's right or the best method. It's just the easiest.
And Jason, I'm sure you even ran into that. You said you had a cell biology background. I mean, you had sort of a sports background, but the one thing I learned when I started working with, you know, in the biochemistry lab is so many of these people are just biologists or chemists, even. Like, exercise is just a blunt instrument. Doesn't mean just whatever. Just give me a stimulus. And then when I'm sitting there, it's like, oh, we got to sit down and think about this and talk about this. And I found that was a bit, so many people in sport and exercise science, like, we all come from different directions. Where I come from applied, some people are coming literally from a chemistry lab into that lab. So it's like, yeah, it was something I didn't expect.
And then you've got athletes coming in just thinking, go hard or go easy. It's about as much as a lot have got to look at.
To add to this, there are many different parties working with exercise intensities. Of course, it's our pro rider that's stepping up and giving us the reality that some riders might use a measure out of 10 to judge intensity, or even just go hard, go easy. So with the messiness of performance and stochastic nature of exercise intensity, maybe the ideal way to describe intensity for everybody and every intensity doesn't exist. This is probably why FTP, despite its limitations, has stuck around. Other more precise measures may have their benefits, but if they're less practical, no one's going to use them.
I think, Cyrus, you hit it well. It's one of the things is like, well, what is the advantage of this? And I think it's just because it's easy, it's appealing, it's quick and dirty. Like, I can see why people would go after it. Like, FTP is a crappy measure of threshold, and now you have a crappy way to measure that threshold with a graded exercise test. So just be aware. And Thomas Sowell.
There are no solutions. There are only trade-offs. And whatever you do to deal with one of man's flaws, it creates another problem. But that you try to get the best trade-off you can get, and that's all you can hope for.
That's a pretty good representation of that. So anyways, let's move on to the other types here, which is the submaximal anchors. And when we talk about prescribing exercise with submaximal anchors, we basically have to get into a discussion of determining thresholds. We've discussed thresholds a lot on the podcast before. We've devoted an episode to all the ways to determine thresholds. There's two episodes out there around blood lactate testing. We've also recently done two episodes discussing the practices for using critical power. So yes, at the risk of the fact that we beat this one to death, can you give us some of your own insight into the submaximal anchors as a method for determining exercise intensity?
Yeah, so let's start with the gas exchange one, just because they're typically the ones that people use least, because people don't. From a sports body, it's time consuming. People don't have that resources. So we looked at, does the gas exchange threshold or the ventilatory threshold, so GET or VT, and when you hear both of them, they essentially are trying to measure the same thing, right? Or at least it's assumed that they're determinants of the transition between moderate and heavy exercise.
I'm jumping in here to say, if you can remember back in part one, where there was the all-revealing chart of all the lactate threshold measures calculated from one cyclist, and these thresholds ranged from 243 watts up to 338 watts when the maximal lactate steady state was 302 watts. Jason made the point that he would expect to see a chart like this have two clusterings of values that represent the expected response when transitioning from one exercise domain to another. When it comes to both the gas exchange threshold and the ventilatory threshold, the same applies, but I'm guessing you probably already knew that.
So the gas exchange and ventilatory threshold, essentially what they're measuring is a disproportionate increase in your actual ventilation. So the amount of actual physical air you're breathing, not necessarily the oxygen you're consuming. And you can see that, you know, there'll be this nice little linear increase, and then all of a sudden there'll just be this bend and this abrupt shift in a steeper increase in your actual ventilation relative to your oxygen consumption. And I don't think, you know, again, so there isn't really evidence confirming that this is the, if you exercise at 5% above this or 5% below this, you're going to be in the moderate and heavy domain. So there actually isn't any studies confirming that. I think an appropriate study, you might find maybe not be 5%, maybe 10% above and below that, you'll sort of be out of that margin of error, and you might actually find, I actually do believe that study will show that. However, there is no study to show that. And the reason I believe that is because we know that with moderate exercise, the VO2 that you consume is like, there is this plateau. So the demand from the work, the VO2 represents it quite quickly. So what I'm sort of getting at is there's this, I guess what you could say, this lag time between the work you do in a GXT versus the oxygen uptake value. So from minute one to minute two, you go from 30 watts, say you're doing a 30 watts a minute, you go from 30 to 60. Well, the VO2 value that you take at 1 minute and 15 seconds clearly can't represent the work at 60 watts. Like, there's this lag time. It takes a while for the oxygen delivery and the CO2 production to actually travel through from your legs to your lungs to exhale and to inhale. And so we kind of use this assumption that there's a minute lag time. So after a minute of exercising at this intensity, especially a moderate one, we're going to see that the VO2 is actually going to represent that. So we know that at moderate intensities that the mean response time, or the time for that leg to sort of catch up, is it usually can take about a minute. Okay. And hopefully that wasn't too confusing.
Actually, Nick, this is a very clear explanation for why you think that the gas exchange and ventilatory thresholds essentially measure the same thing, but with different methods. However, I know that you do not believe this for
the respiratory compensation point,
also referred to as the second ventilatory threshold, VT2.
And this is another disproportionate increase in ventilation. It's proposed to represent the heavy to severe domain. But this lag time gets exacerbated. I can't say that word. It's too long. And I don't honestly believe that the VO2 that is associated with the respiratory compensation actually represents the actual demand from the work. And this has been corroborated by some researchers in Canada, where they found that this mean response time is so light, to get an appropriate measure of the respiratory compensation point, you need a very long GXT, like 30 minutes. And then we're getting back to these other issues of a 30-minute GXT, which is pointless.
So
I think the gas exchange to VT has some utility. It needs to be confirmed, the respiratory compensation point. It's greatly affected by protocol design as well. GET, VT, not so much, but again, needs to be confirmed.
Okay, so now we're pretty deep into this episode. We've covered maximal anchors, like VO2 max, max heart rate and power, plus submaximal anchors like the gas exchange and ventilatory thresholds, and the respiratory compensation point. But we're not done with submaximal anchors just yet. We have two big ones to come: maximal lactate steady state and critical power. And Nick makes the point that they're both trying to determine the same thing, but
there can be only one.
Here's why.
So we talked about the 30-minute protocol, right? It's kind of arbitrary. And you, as you said previously, it's consistently lower than critical power. So let's assume critical power is an appropriate measure of the heavy to severe domain. Well, then if that is it, and the maximal to steady state is not, or vice versa, we can flip it. Say, let's say the maximal to steady state is and the critical power isn't. Well, one of them has to be wrong. Right, it's not that one is like, oh, it's 20 watts difference. Like, no, one is wrong. They're not different. One method is wrong. We can't sit here and accept both. I reject the 30 minute. However, in my review, I talked about the single visit Maxwell at the steady state. It's developed by this guy, Gernot Ehring. I think I got his name right. He's a German guy. And I emailed him back and forth. And they measured Maxwell at the steady state with a completely different protocol, where actually you're adjusting the changes in lactate, or you're adjusting the work rate to the changes in lactate in real time. Mm-hmm. So you're making decisions throughout the test. Yeah. And I remember reading through the test and I'm like, there is something here. And I tried it immediately on a couple of my cyclist friends and a couple of my buddies who run marathons on the treadmill. And again, hasn't it been confirmed that if you exercise just above this maximal steady state value or below, you'll be in these domains. But I would bet all my money that if you ran a study, you compare it to critical power versus that single visit maximal steady state, they'd be identical. Like, I think you'd have really, really good agreement if it was carried out on a fit population and done very well. I actually do believe that. Because when I did test the people, I was finding like, oh, this maximal steady state method is 20 to 25 watts more than the 30-minute criteria. Imagine that. And I think, and you know, obviously the pitfall is you don't get W prime and you then have to then take blood lactate. It is a pretty long test. It takes over 30 minutes. Yep. Nonetheless, like, and even I remember subjectively watching these guys run, I'm like, oh, I can definitely tell that guy's in the severe domain right now. Like, just by the way he's straining and way he's running, I can definitely tell. And then you bring him right below. Yeah. So I really do believe that one. However, I'm going to say like critical powers, I think, is the best model to do so.
Coming up, we wrap up the review and find out what happened when Nick put all of this knowledge to work in an acute training trial, and we get to some practical tips about what we've learned over the last couple of episodes. I just want to take a quick break here to say thanks for stopping by and listening to the show, and remind you that if you find value in the show, it would mean a lot to us if you shared our content with other cycling performance enthusiasts in your life. Also, if you are seeking some additional guidance in the world of cycling performance beyond what we deliver in the podcast, we're keen to help you. My co-host and I offer coaching services for cyclists and consulting services for cycling coaches and teams. Our objective is to provide support tailored to your specific goals and increase the level of confidence you have in your cycling performance results. So definitely check us out online and contact us with any inquiries you may have. Links to each of our websites can be found in the show notes of this episode. Welcome back to the Cycling Performance Club podcast with Dr. Nicholas Jamnik.
So the last method that we have here for looking at and prescribing exercise intensity is this combining like maximal and submaximal resting values, and then looking at, I don't know how it is, deltas. This is something I've never really used before, but I could see like maybe, but not like it just gets to me, it gets a little bit complicated, but I'll let you go with that one. First of all, describe it like how you would do it.
I forgot it was a thing. So you, instead of using absolute value, using a relative value. So instead of using heart rate max, using the reserve, if you will. So if your max is, heart rate max is 200, resting heart rate is 50, your reserve is 150. So you're taking a percentage of that reserve. Mm-hmm. So if it's 50% of the reserve, you're adding on 75 beats to 50 beats, which gives you 125. Now look, heart rate reserve is better than heart rate max, but it's not good at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Same, and so the same goes with the VO2 max, VO2 reserve. And then the same, so they also have done this with the deltas with thresholds and max values. So it'd say, oh, what's the difference between LT1 and W max? Or work rate max. And it's like, okay, yeah, but you still run into the same issue where 70% of that difference doesn't actually coincide with any domain. So yeah, there's not much more to say about
it's
just, there.
It's getting back to trying to figure something out in physiology with a linear model.
I think
that's always going to be kind of problematic. So we don't really have to talk about that one. It just sucks. And we'll move on. Like, don't use that one either, because it just gets back into the same issues that you'd find with the maximal anchoring.
Well, that was a quick and easy one to go through. Now that we have gone through all of the methods and models in this review, it's time to sum up the findings.
I think for the most part, like for the conclusions that you had from your review, just kind of looking through them here, like basically the practical take-homes from it would be, don't use heart rate max or VO2 max peak power outputs to determine zones or training zones. It just seems like it's going to be kind of worthless. And then you say that there is evidence to support the validity of LT1 and the gas exchange threshold and VT to kind of delineate in the moderate and heavy domains of exercise. However, there is little consensus regarding the methodology required to establish these submaximal anchors. So again, more rabbit hole there. Another finding that came up in your conclusions was the various delta methods yield more homogeneous physiological responses than the fixed, but they're still kind of crap at the end of the day. And more research is required to determine the key signals that are altered by different exercise intensities and sensed in the body to initiate the adaptive response to exercise. And then this actually gets into kind of one of the really, really interesting questions about when we start measuring intensity around acute exercise is, what does it even mean? Like, right? Like, one of the things that you pointed out in your introduction, something we were talking about before you came into the room here, was like, yeah, so you, even if you demarcate these different intensities and you're very good about exercising in those intensities, we don't know what it means to exercise in these intensities in terms of adaptations that come from them. We have some ideas, but like, you know, what's your thoughts on this?
Before Nick answers this question, what is Jason even talking about? You ride in a moderate domain, you're going to build endurance, right? Well, this even raises questions, as is written in the conclusion of the review.
However, a key unresolved question in exercise science is the physiological basis for the effects of different intensities on the adaptive response to exercise. More research is required to determine the key signals that are altered by different exercise intensities and sensed by the body to initiate the adaptive response to exercise. More training studies are also required to better understand chronic adaptations to different exercise intensity prescriptions.
It's lucky then that Nick went on to complete an acute exercise trial. It's even luckier still that he let us in on the results of this to-be-published paper.
Talk about the results a little bit. So what we did was we did an acute exercise trial, repeated measures. So they came in three different times. And we used the maximal at a steady state and 30-minute criteria. And there's one thing I learned about your PhD, sometimes you just have to do what you're told. So I used the maximal at a steady state. So just leave it at that. And so what we did is we did an intensity above that. So plus 6% above that. We did 6% because the error of the measurement was 3%. So we just wanted to be just twice outside that. And we went minus 6%. So 6% below that. And then 18% below the maximal steady state. So all the intensities were separated by the same absolute power output for the individual, but it was, you know, relative. And we did our best. You know, we got endurance athletes. It was hard to get 10 cyclists or to give us their muscle. And what we were trying to see was like, all right, let's see, is, you know, let's measure all this. We'll measure the intramuscular lactate. We'll measure the blood lactate, VO2. And is there a disproportionate response of like transcriptional activity? So we worked matched them, the trials. So they did the same amount of work in each of them. And I think the average time to exhaustion in the plus 6% was like 35 minutes. And then it was 42 minutes for minus 6%. And then it was 51 minutes or whatever. I can't remember the exact number. Something like that. 50 minutes for the minus 18. And what we found when we did a bunch of qPCR, we did a bunch of phospho, we did a bunch of Western blotting for phospho, like AMPK, calcium chromogen, all these things that get up, all these signals that get upregulated with exercise intensity. We actually found that there was sort of this disproportionate upregulation of protein, so phosphorylation of AMPK, calcium chromogylin, P38, all these kind of classic markers. And then we actually saw that there was a disproportionate increase in the number of genes that were upregulated. So we actually did RNA sequencing. So we looked at 24,000 genes that transcribed mRNA and found that the whole number of genes upregulated was actually like twice as much. So from taking a step from negative 18 to negative 6 and negative 6 to plus 6, we found that there was this like disproportionate increase in genes that were regulated. And so big, expensive way to say that intensity matters.
So there's more upregulation around that high intensity.
In a single bout of exercise, yeah. So that's essentially what we showed. So it was interesting because, you know, that was kind of the last bit of the PhD where all the other research that looked at how intensity matters. So the main paper was from 2010, where they looked at 40 versus 80% of VO2 max. And of course, the 80%, they saw bigger transcription. It's like, all right, no, we need to figure out like, do these thresholds or these domains actually matter? And can we stay, put two intensities in the heavy domain and then one in the severe and see what happens? And that's what we did. So.
Yeah. For the listeners, you have to be careful though, because it's not a training study. You're looking at the first part of the stream. Like, we don't know what's going to happen, the translation, all that kind of stuff. But it's crazy to see where the science is right now, and where, man, if you get to the wrong coach or talking to the wrong person about like, this interval session that I made up will have this outcome. Really? How do you know that?
Well, that was as funny as they were like, well, let's do a training study. I'm like, no, we're not doing a training study. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, why would I just have all these people work at plus 6%, all these people work at negative 6 at 18 for 8 weeks? I know what's going to happen. Like, one's going to get more fit than the other. And that who cares? Like, that's irrelevant.
Yeah. And if you look at training studies, unless it's set up very kind of organically, where like with my study, we were just like, okay, we're just going to do these two interval sessions per week with you, and then you train normally outside of that. Just don't do any high intensity and we'll just track it. Is it the best design? No, the best design might've been like to control for everything.
Yeah.
But I mean, then you're just talking about an insanely hard study to run.
Yeah.
There's that trade off there.
Yeah. The best training studies are the retrospect that look at elite athletes. Those are the best training studies. What did the best do? And what was the common features of why they won their medals? That's the best. No one gives out, you know, no one's giving out gold medals.
I would argue against that, but I think it was a training study that came out of, I can't remember who did it, but it was one of the prescriptive intensity distribution studies where they actually, instead of looking at it retrospectively in terms of intensity distribution analyses, they actually set up the training around that. And that's, I think it was Stilta. It might've been Stilta. It might've been him. It looked like it was a PhD study or something like that. And it must have been a huge study. And it got published in Frontier, so imagine that's free. But even then there was like maybe a tiny bit more volume within the polarized group. So
yeah, I know which paper you're talking about. But I guess what I meant to say was the retrospect offered more insight into training. That's what I should have said.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So to just kind of look what they're doing. But then again, you're like, you look at what they're doing, you know, is it really work or is it just coaching lore that's like controlling the studies or the what the athlete thinks is best, you know?
That polarized training study was by Thomas Skogel and Billy Spurlick. By the way, nice work on that, guys. But back to the topic at hand here. What are Nick's final thoughts on the practical side of training intensities?
A lot of it comes down to the event. I'd be pretty hard pressed to say that a track cyclist doesn't need to know their critical power. I think that's would it be extremely useful for them. Threshold is most beneficial. Like, you know, I don't know how it is to train or even do for the tour. I mean, I watch it. You know, there's got to be some sort of physiological measure that's extremely important, and they would probably swear by. So, I mean, a lot of it's dependent upon your event or your resources or what are you even doing. I think personally, for the marathon, critical speed is pretty irrelevant.
At the beginning of the episode, I spoke about the episode challenging you to question your current exercise intensity method and model. So where are you now? How will this review, even just this podcast, impact your cycling training? Are you in a place where you can at least see that a validated measure like critical power has benefits? If you are, and it's relevant to your discipline, let's get some practical advice on testing and then making your own training zones, which is exactly what Jason asked Nick.
If someone wanted to come up with training zones, what's the best way to do it?
That was my question, Jason.
I have it on the sheet already. So let's say someone wants to determine training zones. Can you give us how you do it or how you think you would do it with cyclists?
Thanks, Jason, but I'm going to answer this one. Not from my own knowledge, but from what I've learned over the last two episodes. What I've learned over the last two papers is that it all comes down to two measures. For accuracy, validity, and practicality, these measures represent the changes in domains, firstly, from moderate to heavy, and secondly, heavy to severe. The first one is what we learned about in part one, the aerobic lactate threshold, or LT1. And fine-tuning an at-home graded exercise test is how you determine this one. But we spoke about this in part one, so go back and listen to the details to understand better how to do that test for yourself. The second is critical power. And this is done by all-out trials at various lengths. Jason recommends at least 3 bouts and probably an anchor. So probably up to 4, so you get a Pmax, maximum power, meaning that there's a short trial of approximately 2 to 3 minutes, a long trial that's less than 15 minutes, and a trial that's greater than 5 minutes. But even 5 minutes would do, but it has to be between the longest and the shortest trials. And then you want to throw in a max sprint, or maybe even a longer one, like a 20-minute effort. You can plug this into a calculator. You just have to search on the internet for a 3 or 4 trial critical power calculator, and then you're on your way. Okay, so we're going to climb out of the rabbit hole now. Is that even a thing? Anyway, we went down this rabbit hole of exercise intensity and training zones to explore an area of training science that's full of controversy and opinions because it's complicated and messy. But it's also the basis of a big chunk of performance development. We never set out to change anyone's mind on what method to use. And as I've said already, there are many factors that contribute to what you use and why you use it. And I get that. It's just when someone like Nick comes along and does some great work highlighting inaccurate assumptions around these methods I don't know about you, but it makes a compelling case and it's hard to ignore. It certainly got my attention when I read it, but most of all, it's science like this that arms me with knowledge and gives me confidence that the methods I choose are the best possible option for myself and my athletes. Thank you, Nick, for jumping on the show. You can reach out to Nick, especially if you can't get hold of the review.
Reach out to me on ResearchGate or Twitter and I can send it to you if you really want it.
And please make sure you subscribe to or follow this podcast in whatever app you use to listen to the podcast. Go ahead, you can find that button. It's got to be in there on the app somewhere. It's probably a heart or it says follow or subscribe. It's in there somewhere. Go ahead, click it right now while you're listening. Please and thank you.